still think he's one heck of a player and can be.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Outside the Studio. I'm your host, Matthew Blitner. To my left, back from his hiatus, his co-host, Daniel Green. And in case you didn't catch our theme song, written by Jessica Page to Mary, whose full works are accessible online at jdcompositions.com, this is Outside the Studio. And yes, I said it twice. So, for the next 59 minutes, please sit back, relax, enjoy some hot and cold sports takes. And Dan, we want to get this out of the way now because we have a loaded show to get to. And that is our weekly NFL Pick'em Challenge. Last week, ladies and gentlemen, Dan closed the gap to the narrowest of margins. He's currently 1 point back of me. I'm up 33-32. Dan, I never thought I'd see the day that I'd have to say that you're actually within 1 point. Enjoy it while it lasts, because I plan on knocking you far, far, far down the National Football League mountain. So why don't you give it to us straight right now? Who are your three picks for this weekend's games?
I'll tell you what. I, like my first team that I'm going to pick, am coming off a bye week. When you're coming up off a bye week, you're fresh and you're ready to go. And that's what I feel about my pick'ems, and that's what I feel about the Baltimore Ravens. They're playing the Vikings this week. The Vikings are extremely inconsistent. The Ravens, Lamar Jackson has at points looked like an MVP-type candidate. The receiving core has improved. Harbaugh has been coaching well, I felt. I felt like he's been trusting his guys. So that's what I'm going to have to go with first. For my second pick, I know that this is going to be, you know, the Chiefs had not had a good season thus far, but I can't necessarily see them losing this week. They're playing
Packers.
I have them winning this week, because after all of the stuff with Aaron Rodgers that happened, they're going to be a tough team. They're going to be in a tough situation. Jordan Love, maybe someday he'll be good, but he has not shown that so far. And I know they're 7-1, but without Aaron Rodgers, I don't see it.
For those of you who are wondering where Aaron Rodgers is, my co-host over here,
read the news.
Aaron Rodgers said that he was immunized against COVID-19. Now, that's a very, very, very subjective word, evidently, because it means that he was implying that he was vaccinated. No. He's not vaccinated against COVID-19. The National Football League and the Packers both knew that he was not vaccinated. He had applied for an exemption for alternate therapy treatment, which the league denied about a month ago. So he is not vaccinated, and he is out this week with COVID-19. Obviously, we hope that he feels better from it. No one wants to contract the disease. But it's something that the National Football League needs to look into, because a lot of unvaccinated player protocols were most certainly not followed by Aaron Rodgers and the Green Bay Packers.
And this is what happens. And it's really not about football. I mean, we've consistently talked on this show about how we don't condone any of that type of behavior. And ultimately, this week, to bring it back to pick'ems, I do think they play the price. Now, if you told me about this game last year, I would have been like, wow, what an unbelievable game in the middle of the season. The Chiefs are struggling. The Packers are struggling. But I see the Chiefs getting back on track this week. And finally, to close it out, even though it's a road game, I see the Chargers getting back on track as well. The Eagles have been, you know, they've fought well. I did not think that their hiring was a good hiring for their coach, but they have played a lot better this season, And I think ultimately they're an okay team and a tougher out, so that's why they're 1 point. But I think the Chargers are going to start to separate themselves and become a playoff team.
Well, that is your pitch. Again, that stands. Three is the Ravens, two is the Chiefs, one is the Chargers. And I, however, am looking at a nice clean sweep here this week. I've got the Rams as my 3-point pick. They're at home against the Derrick Henry-less Tennessee Titans. Without Derrick Henry, and let's have a brief moment of silence for those fantasy owners whose seasons are now going down the drain, myself included, because Derrick Henry is out for the rest of the regular season. All right, moment of silence observed. Thankfully, I'm still in first place, but for how much longer, that's probably not going to happen. So Rams should have no issue going against the Titans. My 2-point pick, I've got the Dallas Cowboys defending their home turf against the Denver Broncos, who after a hot start have fallen apart. Cowboys look like the real deal in the NFC East, and they look like they could be a legitimate contender in the NFC overall. And then my 1-point pick, I have to say, for the Packers, with no Aaron Rodgers in there, maybe in 3 years from now, Jordan Love would make this an interesting matchup. But right now, that's not going to be the case. Even if the Chiefs play to 75% of their ability, even if they only pull out the win by 1 point, they're still going to pull out the win in this game. They will find a way to do it. So my 3 is the Rams. My 2 is the Cowboys. My 1 is the Chiefs. And we'll see where we stand next week on that. Right now, we need to get into the Jets and Giants. Dan, the Jets looked like they were about to have a quarterback controversy. Sunday, for those of you who missed it, Mike White, who had never started a game in the National Football League, had been cut 4 times, I believe, started in place of the injured Zach Wilson and led the Jets to a win over the Cincinnati Bengals, who were among the top teams in the AFC record-wise. He threw for over 400 yards, 3 touchdowns. Yeah, he had 2 picks, but they weren't his fault. And it got everyone excited to see if this is going to be a flash in the pan. Is this going to be like Matt Flynn a few years ago when he had the 6-touchdown game?
Great reference. Great.
Or, you know, is he legitimately going to take Zach Wilson's job? You know, Robert Saleh left that door open, surprisingly. He came out last night, Mike White, started 3 of 3 against the Colts in Indianapolis, led the Jets to a touchdown on their second drive, a field goal on their next drive. Things were going well. We were ready for a full-blown quarterback controversy in East Rutherford, New Jersey. And then Jets became the Jets. Mike White got hurt with a forearm injury when he got hit on a pressure. He had to leave the game. Josh Johnson, the famous Josh Johnson, who hadn't played a game since, I believe, 2018, came in. Jets found themselves down 45-10. Garbage time got them to 45-30. Dan, we were robbed. We were straight up damn robbed of the opportunity to have a legitimate Mike White versus Zach Wilson debate.
Well, the thing is, one of the great things about the quarterback position is actually you can be any type of player and be successful. You can be regarded as anything in college. For example, Kyler Murray has been good this season. He was a top pick. Mahomes was a first-round pick. But there is so much grit involved in the quarterback position, hard work, study, intangibles, that actually you can come out of nowhere and be somebody who makes a name for themselves. Do I think Mike White was the one who was doing that? I'm not convinced of that. I think he was a flash in the pan a little bit. It was fun. Bengals have been solid, and he put up good numbers. They scored 34 against the Bengals.
Look, if he would have gone out yesterday and started, let's say 2 of 8 for 20 yards and an interception, then there would be no discussion. There'd be no controversy at all. And you could absolutely say he was 100% flash in the pan. He had the career game. He had the Matt Flynn game, and that was it. But he came out looking, and the Jets were moving their offense. They were tied 7-7. Then they were down, I think it was 10-7. No, they were down 14-7, which is still a ball game in football. I mean, one touchdown. He gets them to within 14-10. Everything looked, 14-10 is by no means in today's National Football League an issue. He was rolling. And then fate strikes. Connor Hughes of The Athletic wrote in his game story, you know, he didn't think that curses are real, that voodoo and black magic are real. I got news for you. I'm starting to think that they legitimately, that it's something's buried under
Easter. It's the butt fumble. In the Jets, it's the curse of the butt fumble. We always talk about it on this show.
This goes much further back than the butt fumble.
They've not been good since then. But I still think that ultimately you spent the first pick on Zach Wilson. You spent the second pick in the first round on him. He is the guy right now that you have to give the opportunity to. He does have talent. He does have the accuracy. He has not shown it this year completely, but a lot of guys start out inconsistent. I think he still needs a chance. You still need to build him that base. So I think there shouldn't be a controversy, but I do like seeing Mike White. I hope all the best for him. I mean, even Josh Johnson. It's good to see any of these guys.
All right, let me ask you something over here. Next week, the Jets take on the Bills, the high-flying, high-powered AFC Eastern Division rival Buffalo Bills, who are probably the AFC favorites at this point.
Yes.
Zach Wilson, maybe he gets clear to come back, maybe not. We don't know the medical reports yet. We're still a few days away from those medical reports. Mike White, by all intents and purposes, looks like he would be fine to start that game by the current medical reports coming out after last night's game. You really going to throw Zach Wilson to the Wolves? So I got news for you. Zach Wilson, if he's starting against the Buffalo Bills, coming right off an injury when he's still probably, even if he gets clearance, probably not 100%. I'm letting you know right now, that's going to be an ugly, ugly game. And the second he throws an interception, the Jets fans in attendance are going to be yelling for Mike White. Well, and when they are yelling for Mike White, that is going to absolutely destroy whatever confidence Zach Wilson has.
Well, what's more interesting that you bring up is that I think a lot of times people do rush to bring first-round picks into the games. Patrick Mahomes sat a year. Aaron Rodgers sat 3 years. Brady sat a year. So I kind of get that side of it of, do we want this guy to come back against the Bills when he even had a three-pick game against the Patriots earlier in the season, or do we want to give him more room? Now, BYU is a high-pressured school where he came from. He has, you know, he has experience with dealing with pressure. I still think you want him to get the reps. I think you want him to get the experience. And again, you're not a playoff team. You're not a team that's looking to be competitive. You're a team that's looking to see what you have. And I got news for you. Yes, the offense, he hasn't been great. This defense gave up 45 points and couldn't stop
anybody. 2 weeks after giving up 50, and it's given up over 500 yards.
Like, they have not been good, and Robert Saleh is a defensive-minded guy. So to see this defense be this bad, it just means that there's a talent deficiency.
Obviously, there's a talent deficiency. We could go on about this all day, but right now we need to get to the Giants before we get to our first guest today. The Giants, oh boy, Dan.
They're heartbreaking. I'm a Giants fan. It's heartbreaking.
I have to say, it's time for the gavel to be rained down on Joe Judge's tenure. Plain and simple.
I'd start with Gettleman.
Gettleman needs to go too, but I'm going to say that, you know, considering that I'm working for back channels to try to get Gettleman on the show, let's not bash him too badly. So, Joe Judge, look, it's one thing if the team's just going to straight up lose games. It's another thing for them to find ways to lose games, which is what the Giants are doing. But for him to come out with the ridiculous headset comment, Dan, there are preschoolers who know how to give a better excuse.
Okay, let's give him all the benefit of the doubt in the world and say that in all 8 of their games, they couldn't use headsets. Johnny Unitas never used a headset, okay? Headsets are important to today's game. It is completely understandable why they are used. But if you've had this problem in 8 consecutive games, as he's claimed, if you wasted 5 timeouts, basically, I mean, at least 2 at the end of the game, but as many as 5 on silly headset issues, then you have to figure out another system.
Especially when the NFL has said that there are no issues.
But even if there were, no, that's my point. I don't necessarily think there are those kind of issues, but even if there were, you figure out another way to communicate with your players and you don't mismanage the game. This team has undisciplined penalties. This team wastes timeouts. This team doesn't manage time well. That's what's held them back. They drop passes in key situations. That's what a losing team does. That's what a losing culture does. And Judge had so much of a winning culture that last year, so I don't necessarily want to throw him out. I do want to throw out Gettleman. I really think he has not built a good team here.
But Dave, if you're out there listening right now, my co-host, I'll throw him out before we before we get you on the show if you and the Giants agree to it. So don't worry. He's not going to be here for you. We're not trying to bury you, Dave Gettleman. You can ride off into your retirement after this.
No, I mean, clearly he's done a lot for the National Football League, but and around the league, and he's obviously a prominent executive. But again, this team, it's just a team that has found ways to lose. It's a team that's sloppy. It's a team that has some talent, but at the end of the day, the line is not good enough to protect Daniel Jones.
Well, that's our New York Jets, New York Giants report following our Pick'em segment this week. For more, obviously, you can always follow us on social media, and you can, of course, go on our Podomatic, Spotify, anywhere you get podcasts to hear this show on repeat. Right now, I'm going to go get our first guest. He's a Hockey Hall of Famer. He played for the New York Rangers during the We Did Everything But Win era, and he deserves to have his number retired. It hasn't been yet, so there's a lot to talk about with him, especially since he was in one of the most controversial trades in New York Ranger history. Dan, I'm going to go get our guest, Brad Park, while you vamp.
It's been a real privilege these last couple of shows to get former players onto the show, especially from this era. There's a lot that was different and a lot that my generation doesn't necessarily know about those late 60s, early 70s Rangers. And part of that was the team was cursed. Obviously, there's a lot of stories about why the team didn't win a Stanley Cup for many years. But even though they didn't win a Stanley Cup, this team had a lot of talent. As Matt said, the book came out. They did everything but win. This was a team that had a lot of the pieces there and should be celebrated. He should be celebrated. I'm excited to speak with him about his time playing and excited to speak with him about what he thinks about today's game.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're back with former New York Ranger Brad Park. Brad, how are you today?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Glad to hear, and thank you for joining us here on Outside the Studio. And Brad, I'm going to get this started off really simple. Yesterday, the Buffalo Sabres traded Jack Eichel to the Vegas Golden Knights. Now, a lot of people have debated what the, you know, whether the return is commensurate with a star of Eichel's caliber. So there's a lot of different ways that people can think about that. You yourself, in the mid-70s, were traded from New York to Boston for Rick Middleton. So you have a little experience in what it's like for a star player to be involved in a trade of this magnitude. What is your take on trades like this?
Well, I think there's a number of different factors that are involved in the game now. And one of them is salary and length of contract. That was not necessarily a concern back in the 70s. You know, you trade guys because, you know, you're more interested in trying to improve your team. And, you know, trying to get quality for quality or make a steal if you could.
Well, it's a good answer there. And, you know, it's so interesting, you know, how the game has changed in regards to just the way it's played as well as how it's handled off the ice, you know, especially as you mentioned with the contracts and everything. It's something that it's almost incomparable, but you have to wonder, what was going through your mind when you were informed of your trade, and do you think that Eichel had similar thoughts?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, number one, I'm not sure what the rumors were before. When I was traded, there was no rumors about me at all. We had made some prior movements that were not, you know, that I thought were somewhat detrimental to the team. But, you know, you don't see it coming unless there's rumors or, you know, somebody has heard something on the QT.
So you played for both Boston and New York. I'm somebody who spent time living in Boston and New York. I've seen both types of fans. How would you compare the passion and the types of fans that you experienced while you were in Boston and while you were in New York?
Well, I think the fans in both places are great fans. I mean, they're unbelievable. You know, they support, they call you out when they think you're not doing your job as well as they want. Their passion for the game is unbelievable. New York was so big that, you know, I could walk around by the garden, and nobody would recognize me, during the day. If I walked around the Boston Gardens or downtown Boston, they knew me right away. So it was a little bit different thing where in New York you could hide and in Boston you couldn't.
Well, it's interesting that you say that you could hide in New York. I mean, you think that when you think of icons and famous people, whether it be entertainers or athletes, celebrities, whatever, it seems like New York, everyone would recognize you. But I guess that's part of the benefit of being a hockey player in a sense. And I want to compare something here. The late Roger Bear, said that the Rangers never won the Cup during those years because the Cat, Emil Francis, that your teams never quite had the same ice tops like the Bruins had. Everyone knew the Bruins as the big, bad Bruins. They were going to, even if they lost a game, they were going to exact a physical amount of flesh from their opponents. The Rangers were the more skill, dazzle type of team. And you could say that that's pretty much very similar to how both teams are even to this day. So what's your take on this? I mean, the Bruins, obviously, in the 70s, they won a couple of times. Rangers obviously did not. So just what's your take on this?
Well, I think as far as going head-to-head against the Bruins, we had guys that would go the distance. Vic Hadfield, myself, Teddy Irvin, everybody was willing to duke it out. I think the difference that we had in the Bruins was they had the best player in the game. It was Bobby Orr. He was that good. And twice when we played him in the playoffs, he was the difference. The year after we lost to them in 72, we came back and we beat them in 73. So, at that time, and Bobby Orr was not himself in 73, he was still having knee problems and not being able to function as well. But in 72, in the Stanley Cup Finals, he was the difference.
He definitely was. And you mentioned about Bobby Orr, so I'm going to bring this into a bit of a wider conversation at the moment. Today, and I don't know how much hockey you watch currently, but the Rangers have the reigning Norris Trophy defenseman in Adam Fox. Obviously, a lot of people, even in the media, are comparing Adam Fox to Brian Leetch. Of course, Brian Leetch came after your time with the Rangers, but he sort of continued that legacy of great defensemen that you, of course, were part of. So between yourself or Leetch, and I hate to do it, but I'm going to throw Fox in just because he's the modern-day equivalent, who had or has the better skill set of the four of you?
Well, I think that Bobby Orr is, heads and shoulders above all of us. His skating ability, and it actually was his downfall because he had this great skating ability and he would see a hole and he would go for the hole. And if he got through, it was a highlight reel. If he didn't, he took a lot of punishment. And when I skated with the puck, there was no way I was going to get through that hole, and I knew it. So Brian Leetch was great offensively defensively, and he was unbelievable with the Rangers. Adam Fox, I looked up, I just kind of looked at his stats, and my rookie year I had more penalty minutes than he's had in 3 years. So there's a little difference there.
Of course, and it's actually funny that you should put Orr, above all three of you guys, because I have it on good authority, and to protect everyone, I'm not going to give their names, but I have it on good authority that Orr once told a reporter that he felt personally that Brian Leetch was better than he was because Leetch could do things that he could not from a physical standpoint. So it's interesting that you should put Orr above yourself, Leetch, and Fox, when Orr himself puts Leetch above himself.
Yeah, I think, I think in the 17 years that I played, I never missed the playoffs. So I think that's a standard that you would like to hold everybody to.
You obviously played for a lot of great teams. obviously making the playoffs every year is an unbelievable accomplishment. And a part of that obviously was because you had such a great career, but you also were surrounded by some great coaches. So who did you feel like the coaches that really made an impact on you were?
Well, I think the most organized coach that I ever played for was Emil Francis. And that being said, you know, we would have every game, we would have three breakouts, three forechecks, and he would change them on the bench. He never had to go in the dressing room to change, you know, how we broke out or how we were going to forecheck. He would do it while the game was going on, and that was an unbelievable advantage. On faceoffs, everybody knew what their responsibilities were, what he knew what everybody else's responsibilities were, and that was gone over time and time again. I think the best motivator that I ever had was Don Cherry. And he was, you know, a great motivator to get you up for the games. He would tell these stories that sometimes had no relevance. But by the end, he had you all hyped up, ready to go. And I think the best combination of the two of them was probably Harry Sinden.
You want to talk about a great list of coaches right there. I mean, that's exactly what you just gave. You know, each one of those coaches had a good amount of success. Now, after your time in Boston, you went to Detroit for a couple seasons. And, you know, you, by all means, you were still pretty much the same player that you had been. Something somewhere along the line didn't quite click. You know, so what was it that didn't quite click? You know, there were rumors that maybe there was a bit of a rift between you and Jimmy Devolano. You know, why did things not maybe mesh as well in Detroit?
Well, I played there 2 years, and the last 2 years of my career, and both years they hadn't made the playoffs in 7 years, and they hadn't made it back to back in 17 years. And so I played 2 years, and everything. I didn't necessarily get along with the coach very well. And things that, you know, that would bother me or bother the other players is they have a bulletin board, and Jimmy D would come down and post anytime there was a negative call on me, he would post it on the board, you know, so we could all see it, like, you know, trying to motivate us that way. And then after the 2 years, I came back to coach, and I had the title of coach and director of player personnel, which means, you know, anybody in the system on the roster, you know, couldn't be added or couldn't be taken away unless I agreed. And it's at that point that Jimmy and I butted heads.
I mean, and that could make it extremely tough to be on a team when you're just clashing with the coach in that way. And even despite that, it seems like you still had a lot of success while you were there. While you were on the Rangers, you had obviously a great career, and you're, you know, somebody who had a lot of success here. Would you like to see your number retired by the Rangers? Do you feel like it's something that you would want to see, and why do you feel like it hasn't happened yet?
Well, I think anybody would love to see their number retired, but it's, you know, it's out of my control. It's out of my hands. And, you know, if it happens, that would be wonderful. If it doesn't happen, I can live with it. You know, next week I'll be in Florida playing golf regardless.
Well, speaking of golf, just you mentioned right here. So what, you know, are you a good golfer? You know, are we going to expect to see you on the senior PGA Tour anytime?
No, but I have moments of greatness.
Well, moments of greatness sounds like a hockey career. So in regards to moments of greatness, a former teammate of yours obviously had many great moments in the late Rod Gilbert, who we lost just a couple months ago. What was your favorite memory of Rod while you guys were teammates?
Well, I think one of the great things was after I was there for 2 or 3 years, after a game one night, I'm coming out of the shower, and Rod's in front of the mirror, and he's combing his hair, and he's got on this beautiful blue suit. It's like it must be made of silk. It's absolutely gorgeous. And I said, "Hey, Rod, nice suit." He says, "Yeah, you like that?" He said, "I'm going galvanizing." I said, "What?" He said, "I'm going galvanizing." I said, "No, Rod, you mean gallivanting." He says, "Yeah, that too."
Well, that is Rod, and I got to know Rod very well at Darden during the last several years. I have to say it reminds me of a story that I heard about Rod, where at the time when you guys were all playing him, Mickey Mantle, Joe Namath, you know, you want to talk about these sports icons running the town, and Rod said in an interview that he did the best out of all of them, and he most certainly was not talking about gameplay. He was talking about away from the rink. So it's just funny to hear that type of story about Rod. You know, Brad, we thank you so much for joining us. And ladies and gentlemen, if you're just tuning in, we've been talking with Ranger great Brad Park. Brad, before we let you go, I do have one final question for you. 1975, obviously, is not a memory that Ranger fans want to have. It's something that, if they were alive, they'd probably erased. But Islander fans love it. And on that fateful J.P. Parisi goal, you were checking in front, I believe, you know, what went wrong on that play that allowed Parisi to eventually score that goal?
Well, looking back on that, they had won. First of all, it was a 2-out-of-3 series, and it was the last time they ever did a 2-out-of-3 series because we got knocked out and the Bruins got knocked out by Chicago. But on that, you know, we lost the first game. We won big in the island. We came back. We were down 3-0 going into the third period. We tied it up. We hit three posts. We got all kinds of momentum going. But we lose the faceoff at center ice. And when we do that, our wingers peeled off with their wingers. And I met the Islander defenseman at the red line to force the shoot in. And the reason you force the shoot in, so our winger is going to cheat and get back and get possession of the puck. So that's exactly what happened. I went to center ice, forced the shoot in, and I was on the way back. And Jude Drouin yelled our guy's name. He reversed the puck, and I'm coming back and saying, oh, shit. And I just couldn't get back to the front of the net because I was coming from center ice, and J.P. appeared. Parisi just deflected it into the upper corner.
You can hear the pain in your voice still from that. And of course, I'm sure any our Ranger contingent of fans who are listening are probably saying, please, please stop. We don't want to hear about that goal anymore. So we'll let everyone off with that. Brad, thank you so much for joining us here today. We hope you and your family are doing well. And we hope to be able to see you around at one of the many NHL arenas someday soon.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was NHL and Ranger legend Brad Pott. Danny, he really didn't hold back. He told everything as it is. He had some great comments to make.
It's so interesting that he made the playoffs every year that he was a player. And actually, I know a lot of times you could say, well, the team made the playoffs. But if you're that, if you're somebody who made the playoffs every year, you're a big part of that success. And it's not just the way that you play. It must mean that he has a certain type of work ethic, a certain type of example that he set. And obviously, those teams were really good.
They most certainly were. Of course, we all know that the Rangers were the We Did Everything But Win team, as George Grimm immortalized in his book, We Did Everything But Win. Bruins of that era won 2 cups. And now, Dan, we want to get down and serious right now. And this is going to lead into our second guest, Billy Jaffe, who's going to join us in about 9 minutes from now. But we want to talk about how we can change, or what needs to be changed in the sports world in terms of sports culture. Because for anyone who's been paying attention to sports news over the last couple of weeks, it's been one scandal, one story after another. Whether it's the Washington football team, the Phoenix Suns, the Pittsburgh Penguins, the Chicago Blackhawks, the list goes on and on, and enough's enough already. So, Dan, in your estimation here, what as a society and what as a sports world do we need to do here to change things for the better?
Well, there's a couple of different issues that are going on here. So there's part of it that is a level of misogyny. That's what you see in the Phoenix Suns case. And part of it is in a pattern of sexual assault. That's what you see in the Blackhawks scandal. That's what you see in the Penguin scandal. And both of these issues we take extremely seriously, and it has to come from when you're young and when you're playing the game as a young person. It can't just be that you're in your 30s and you receive punishment after you've already done something that's wrong. It's too late by then. There's already somebody who's been a victim of these kind of things. You're already set in your ways to a certain degree. We need to improve the sports culture in Little League, in high school sports, so that by the time you get to the pro level, you're less likely to cover up something. Now, Matt last week eviscerated the league's handling of the Blackhawks, but was it a surprise? No, not to anybody who's been paying attention. None of these stories are new. They're just all being exposed.
Which is part of the problem, because if they're finally being exposed, whether it be 2 years or 3 years like it is in the Penguins situation, or 10, 11 years in the Blackhawks situation, or going back even further, for them to be, for these stories to be hidden is part of what's wrong with society. And Dan, you were telling me during our strip meeting about how when you were on a track team in high school, the leadership of the team, and you didn't mean coaches or anything, you meant the actual players physically in the locker room, were part of why you were able to avoid issues like this.
Well, what I was saying was that that was a unique situation, because I've been on both types of teams, right? I've been on teams where, you know, somebody gets bullied or somebody says something that is misogynistic or is the wrong kind of thing to say, and everyone on the team just listens and just laughs and continues playing. And I've been on teams where that is not the case. And that was, I felt the case on our track team. We were a team where you had a strong group of leaders, and it wasn't just the coach who set a certain tone, it was the players. So I remember my co-captain at that time heard somebody say something at a stadium during a race that was homophobic and that went too far and was really inappropriate for any situation and really is not something we want to encourage. And he was not afraid to say, hey, we don't talk like that. And that was in 2010. That was when people were still in a different kind of mindset. People were just transitioning and just thinking about political correctness and speaking in the proper way. And he had the courage as a 17-year-old to say, hey, we don't do that. And for me, he just had a certain set of values and was a leader and was able to communicate that to the rest of the team. And look, I'm not going to sit here and pretend that nothing else happened for the rest of that season, but mostly people stayed in line and people acted the way that we want to encourage young men to act.
So pretty much what you're saying is it came down to the leadership on the team, but you're not always going to see great leadership. Let's be honest. At the ages of 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, how mature are people really? That, you know, maybe you might have some people who are more mature than their age, and then you have others who probably are not. So you can't necessarily always rely on the team leadership in that room, because if they're not a mature leader, then it doesn't matter that they're a leader.
But well, I think it has to trickle down. Because, for example, let's say you're 8 or 9 or 10 or in high school. You're already at the point where your coaches and people, adults, are, you're not going to necessarily want to listen to them. If they're telling you something is not the right thing to do, you're not necessarily going to change your behavior. But when you hear it from somebody that you are a peer with, it's a positive peer pressure as opposed to a negative one. So if you can just go down the chain of command and the coaches encourage, hey, captains, this is how we are. And if you care about this team, it's the same as if a player is consistently missing practice or not putting in the work, speaking with inappropriate language, it detracts from the team. And if you can, as a coach, can trickle that to the captain and that positive peer pressure could go to the rest of the team, I think you will start to see people clean up the way they speak.
So you're saying that we need to make sure that the coaches are following, good. But as we've seen within the Raiders scandal with John Gruden, clearly the coaches are not necessarily always going to be the thing. And let's be fair. outside of the new crop of teachers who are just starting their careers and getting coaching jobs, you know, in their mid to late 20s, are you really, you know, most of these coaches are, you know, all my little league coaches, I don't think any of them were under the age of 45. Maybe they were 40 at the youngest, but they were probably, you know, 45, 50, 60 years old. And that's still the age of most coaches, whether it be in high school, junior high, little league, whatever. So how do we get them to change? That's who we need. If you're saying that the coaches need to instill it into the leadership of the team, then we need to find a way to get the coaches to change their ways. Because, again, maybe, okay, maybe you might be fine with a 27-year-old coach who's starting to learn this now and has been learning this their whole lives. But a 50, 60-year-old coach, I got news for you, is not going to all of a sudden change. But we need to get them to change.
I mean, I don't know if I completely buy that. I think that a lot of people have changed over the last couple of years. I think you've seen the way that people speak and how people are more careful about what they say in a lot of situations is an example of how they've changed. And I guess that you could do things like have the league punish coaches for players speaking inappropriately, but I think ultimately you're not going to catch people. People need to police themselves because they're the only ones that are on the ground seeing what they're doing every day, and they're the ones that can clean it up.
That's a great point, and it's going to lead us into our interview with NHL analyst Billy Jaffe, who I'm going to go get as our next guest while Dan gives you whatever it is that Dan says while
I'm
away.
This time, it's really a transition from our last conversation. So, look, I didn't get to be here last week. I was away. Matt really did a good job discussing the Blackhawks scandal and everything that went into that. All of the cover-ups, all of the lies, all of the disturbing acts that happened, and everything that happened to that coach, who, by the way, was later promoted. And you might think, well, this is a problem that happened in 2010. Clearly, nothing's changed. You see how poorly the league responded. You see that this problem is not going away. So we're going to start by talking with Billy about that, and then we'll get into some other NHL news.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're joined now by Billy Jaffe. Billy, it's Matt and Dan outside the studio. How are you today?
Hi, Matt. Hi, Dan. How are you guys? I'm doing well. Thank you.
Glad to hear you're doing well. Glad to have you on the show here today. And we were just talking about this, and you mentioned how you had some things that you wanted to say in regards to this when I emailed you about today. So how can the NHL, with everything that we've seen go down the last couple of weeks, with the Blackhawks, now with the Penguins, how can the NHL enact real change after everything that we've now learned?
Well, first of all, I said that would take that would take a whole show into itself, basically. That's what I said. Listen, the NHL and pro sports in general have a lot to do to be better in this area. There's something about, you know, breaking down the barriers of making people feel unsure, unsafe. If they speak up, if they don't find something comfortable, and, you know, a lot of the culture has been, don't say anything, deal with it, you know, behind closed doors, whatever, and, you know, just, you know, figure out a way to get by. And that could be for anything, not just these awful incidents that we've had. And we're in a new world now, guys. You know, you speak with people, not down to them. And that doesn't mean that there aren't times, by the way, as an aside, that sometimes, there's certain things that should be a certain way. But in this instance, safety is paramount. Every individual should know that they're all right. And it can't be, you know, cheap talk. It's got to come from owners. It's got to come from general managers. It's got to come from people that are in place that say, look, if anything happens, you come to me. 1,000% you come to me. But there's so many different ways that we can have this conversation. In general, the big reality is this. We need to make it to where people know that if they say, look, I'm just not comfortable with something that's happened, or if it's severe, this is what happened, that there's going to be something that comes from it, meaning we're going to take a pause, we're going to get investigation right away, and we're not going to put it off for the betterment of the team, quote unquote. You know what I mean? To wait until an event, a tournament, a Stanley Cup has happened.
So you made a good point about how, you know, the investigation, people need, it needs to come from the higher ups. And we're seeing now in the fallout from everything with Chicago and not quite yet with everything from Pittsburgh, because that's a bit of an underreported story. Don Fehr is the executive director of the NHLPA. There's been rumors that a lot of players are displeased with him, to put it kindly. Of course, they are commissioning an investigation into exactly how and why the PA failed Kyle Beach. The owners, you know, Gary Bettman is the spokesperson for the owners, essentially. Any sports commissioner is beholden to the owners of the league. He is the face, the public face, the public voice for the now 32 owners. And it seems like, you know, a lot of people were not happy with that press conference on Monday. Just, you know, a lot of hemming and hawing, not a lot of great answers. People weren't pleased that Kevin Cheveldayoff, the GM of the Jets, basically walked away. I can't even say he got a slap on the wrist, really. I mean, you know, he got called in for a meeting and nothing really happened. They could have at least suspended him. And again, look, I have nothing personally against Cheveldayoff. You know, I've only ever spoken with him a couple of times. I can't say that, you know, he's ever been anything bad to me, but it's not a good optic. And is that part of the problem? Is part of the problem that the league is too worried about appearances to do anything substantial?
Well, I think the league has been, you know, has probably been guilty of that. And other leagues have been, and companies, holy smokes, there are, whether they're Fortune 100, 500, whatever they are, companies have been very guilty of that too. It's again, it's not just a hockey problem, but in our little world, we obviously take that very seriously and very personally, because it's our world, right? I mean, at least for me, that's how I make my livelihood. It's what I do. It's what I love. But I think that optics, times, many facets overshadow or overtake the reality of the situation. And yeah, I mean, it needs to be, optics be damned now. Optics are, you know, I would find it to be more, better, is that term, optically smart, better, correct, I think is the word, optically correct, to say, holy crap, something's happened here. You know it, but we're going to sure as hell take care of it right now. And yeah, it means that our league might not look good here, or our business might not look good here, but you know what? We care so much that we're going to take care of it. We're not going to hum and haw and hedge and wait. That's what I would think.
And that's what I would think too. And I think part of what, there's two parts that I think make this story so disturbing. One is that the league is still kind of trying to cover up itself and is not as open as maybe it needs to be. And the other thing is that a lot of people knew about this. Like, there was a meeting, there were a lot of players who were making references to the Blackhawks, to the whole thing, the next year. So what do you think of the fact that this was not like some hidden story, and that in a certain sense it was open and no one on the ice did anything about it?
Well, that's the biggest shame of it all, is that we, you know, we're finding out that the information was, some at least, was there, right? I didn't know much. I didn't know anything. I know anything about this until recently. And then you start hearing things. How many months ago was it now when we start hearing about, you know, player, whatever it was, player X, and then John Doe. And, you know, I mean, I didn't know. And I'm, by the way, I'm from Chicago. Now, that doesn't mean that I should have inside scoop. I didn't live in Chicago in 2010, but I was involved in the league. I didn't know anything about it. So what we're finding out is that there was some knowledge to it, and that's heartbreaking. You know, it's what I always like to do is this, fellas. I'm not trying to get off of that per se, but I always like to say, what would I feel if that happened to me? What would I feel if that was my child? What would I feel if that was my teammate? What would I feel? And I like to think that I would have done the right thing, right? I would, you know, it's that, by the way, is the easiest thing to say after the fact. Let's not lose sight of that, too. I think a lot of people feel right now that failed before. And I'm hoping, I'm praying that they learn from that. And I would hope and think that I would have done the right thing, but I'm not going to sit here and be all high and mighty and say, no matter what, I would have done the right. I would have said something. I wasn't there, right? I wasn't there. I'd like to think I would, but I don't know. So we're learning all this stuff after the fact, and it's nauseating.
It really is nauseating. And, you know, you mentioned about how, you know, you would like to think, and of course, I'm sure a lot of people would like to think that, you know, if they were there, if they were in charge of the situation, they would have handled it better than what it was. I'm going to take you back right now to shift gears just a little bit. In 1997, at the Maccabiah Games in Israel, you were the team captain for Team USA. You guys won a silver medal, which obviously means a lot. You know, there's only three medals, gold, silver, and bronze, and then everyone else doesn't get anything. There's no participation trophies. So what type of captain were you, and what did it mean to you to be put in that position to be the leader of the team?
Well, it's always a very proud experience, I think, to be a leader of anything. Obviously a hockey team that helps, or that's representing your country, that makes it even more special. And there was a commonality with everybody that was there too. Not only were we athletes and specifically hockey players, but we all had some level of Jewish blood. And there was that connection as well. So very proud of that. As a leader on that team, I would like to think that I was all inclusive. It was very important to me, as it still is today. And I coach youth hockey, and I've coached other events where I want to make sure that everybody knows that they matter, that everybody knows where they stand. Sometimes that means that you have hard conversations. I'm a big believer, fellas, of having honest conversations from the moment, you know, I meet. I do it with the parents of the kids that come play for the team that I'm the head coach on. I tell them from the get-go, this is how I am. This is how I coach. This is what I think. You need to understand that. And if it's not okay with you, then maybe it's not the right place. But I never want anybody to hold anything against me. And as a leader, I think that's important to be that way, but also to understand that everybody's different. So let's say, Dan or Matt, I got to get through to you one way. Well, I got to get to the other guy the other way. And it's no different as a captain, right? You have to figure out the right buttons to get through to everybody. I being a captain in anything, I don't care if it's captain of your elementary school, kickball team, or if it's of an NHL team, which I never was, but, you know, where it's a very special honor, distinction, and something to be taken very seriously.
So right before we started speaking with you, Matt and I were talking about kind of these issues and other kinds of problems that occur in the leagues. And one of the points that we were making is they don't start, for example, people making homophobic comments to player X after all of this stuff happened with him is not something that the attitude to do that doesn't start when you're in your 20s and you're a professional hockey league. That attitude is a mindset that starts when you're younger. So as somebody who's involved with youth sports, what do you think is the key to getting through to people of that age and putting them on the right habits?
Oof. Lead by example. Don't do it yourself. I think, you know, if you hear certain things, you try to talk with them and saying, wait a second, how would you feel if so-and-so said this to you or said that to you? How would that make you feel? And I'd say for some of them, they have that moment of, oh, okay. But some of them, quite honestly, fellas, they don't care because they likely hear it at home. That's where it begins. So, you know, don't do it at home. But, you know, we can't control that. As coaches, we can control, as leaders, you know, we can control what happens with us, around us, but I can't control what happens at somebody's home. And so, and can I try to, when I have that child or that player for the hour and a half, a couple of days a week, make it clear that, A, I don't tolerate it, we don't accept it, and that's not the right thing to do? Sure. Does that can take over for all the, you know, whatever, the amount of hours that player has at home if with their family, if it's being either tolerated, accepted, or encouraged? That's hard to combat. But you're right. It doesn't start at 21 when a player is all of a sudden a pro athlete. It does. It starts much earlier than that.
And Billy, thank you for that synopsis of that. And you really hit it on the head right there about how it starts at home. It doesn't even start in the locker room at 8 years old. It starts in the household. And that's something that we all have to be mindful of. I want to turn our attention right now. You mentioned something about needing to lead by example. And right now in New York, we have a player who is not eligible to be captain by the rules, because goaltenders are not allowed to be captains. And he is very much leading by example. And for our listeners out there, I'm talking about Igor Shesterkin, the Rangers goaltender. The Rangers have 6 wins. He's stolen 4, maybe 5 of them. So, Billy, in your opinion here, you know, you're more than just a coach, and at various levels, you're also an analyst. Is Shesterkin's performance sustainable? And if not, what do the Rangers need to do to pick up their pace around their goaltender?
Well, a lot of layers to that one, too, because what we don't know about Igor Shesterkin, besides that, you know, I wasn't sure about him coming in. Like, I knew he was good. I didn't know how good. I should have trusted Chris Kreider from a couple of years ago, who told me that he was awesome. Kreider told me a few years ago when I was talking to him about some other stuff too. He said, no, this kid is the real deal. And it's not that I don't believe Chris Kreider. I absolutely do. But I hadn't seen enough of Shesterkin myself. So I've seen more and more of him. I love his competitiveness. I love his athleticism. But what I don't know, the godforsaken crazy world that we live in, I don't know what he's going to be like over an 82-game season. So I've got all these questions, not just about Igor, but other players too, that these young guys that have never played an 82-game season, that have never played games outside of their time zone. Like, this is the first time that Shesterkin, right? Like Jeremy Swayman, the same type of thing with the Bruins. Last year he played in a 56-game season, but hardly played. He only played 10 games for them, but he never played a game outside the Eastern Seaboard, Eastern time zone. So this is such a different year. We're going to learn so much about all these players. I think he's the real deal. As of today, whatever the date is, as we sit here, Matt, and talk about it, you know, he looks like an ultra-competitive, ultra-focused, ultra-athletic netminder. With all that said, can his body withstand 50 games, 55 games? Because I think if they're going to stay in the playoffs, it looks to me like he's going to have to play those 55 games. Maybe 60 would be pushing it, I think. But after that, let's see. You know, like, I mean, what are they going to have to do? Well, they're going to have to help him defend better. That's what it always comes down to. Don't give up as many grade-A chances against. Keep pucks out. Get pucks in. All the hockey cliches I can give you. But it's just about defending better. I like the Rangers. I think, you know, they're in a tough division this year. I don't need to tell you guys that. I'm sure you've talked about it on your show before. The Met is really good. That's probably going to work against them. But doesn't mean that they can't compete for, let's say, the last. Maybe they compete for the fifth. You know, they get the wild card spot as the number 5 seed in that division. And if they do that, I think Shesterkin will have a big hand and a big glove in it as well.
Well, Billy, thank you so much for that analysis. And, you know, I think it's entirely possible that if, you know, after the Rangers had a Norris Trophy winner in Fox last year, that if Shesterkin's going to take him to the playoffs, he might very well pull in the Vezina. So we'll see. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're just tuning in, we've been talking with NHL analyst Billy Jaffe. Billy, before we let you go, one very, very quick answer right here. Gun to your head, who's winning the Stanley Cup this year?
Oh, God, I can tell you who's not. Probably a lot easier.
Well, that's 31 teams who are not. So we're on the clock here. Final minute.
Yeah,
what?
I'll give you a couple of teams real quick that right now look to be. I do think that Carolina is close. I got to see Freddie Anderson in the playoffs. Florida, let's see. I'm not still as well as Bobrovsky's played early on. I'm still not ready to say him all the way. Spencer and I could take over. I still think Colorado, when they get healthy, they get through all the COVID, everything. I still think Colorado is a really, really good team. And I, you know what? I'm starting to buy St. Louis a little more, but I don't know. It might be a little recency bias having watched them twice lately. They're a hell of a team, though.
Well,
so maybe one of those four.
Well, thank you, Billy, so much, and best to you and your family. And we hope to that you might be right on one of those predictions.
Predictions? Well, I was going to say something. I'm rarely right, and like many people aren't. I couldn't care less if I'm right or not. I just want to analyze the right way when it's all said.